Good evening. Good evening, everyone. My name is Carolina Celadon, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are gathered today in a place that lies within the traditional territory of the Susquehannock, the Shawnee, and the Lenape Indigenous peoples who inhabited this land for centuries prior to the arrival of European settlers. On behalf of the Clark Forum, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, the Departments of Philosophy, American Studies, Sociology and Anthropology, and the Health Studies Program, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, The Biology of Inequality. This program was initiated by the Clark Forum Student Project Managers. Certain populations of people, namely people of color and those of a lower socioeconomic status, are more vulnerable to injustice in just about every aspect of life. These injustices and the environment around them shape not only their perspective, but also affect their biology. Biological anthropologists have been grappling with the idea of epigenetics, the programming of gene expression that does not depend on the DNA code, and thinking about how social factors and the environment in which these minority groups live are linked to their gene expression. The gene expression can be seen through wide-ranging health disparities, from higher rates of depression to asthma to heart failure. Consequently, minority groups deal with the ramifications of their subjugated position in society, even in terms of health. While genetics and biological anthropology are fields that I have not fully dived into myself, I have always been somewhat familiar with them because of my father. My father is a doctor whose research focuses on solving the puzzle of asthma disparities among Latino populations. His work, which is primarily related to Puerto Rican and Central American children, explores how factors like stress, violence, and the environment affect rates of asthma. Learning about these health disparities has taught me that inequalities are far-reaching and pervade everything we do. Minority groups must bear the burden of higher rates of disease and illness, and in some cases, even pass these susceptibilities on to future generations. I am grateful for scholars like Zenaida Thayer, who reveal some of the effects of injustice by merging the worlds of societal norms and science. Our speaker this evening, Zenaida Thayer, is a biological anthropologist who focuses primarily on evaluating how factors such as poverty, trauma, and ethnic discrimination affect health. She is assistant professor of anthropology at Dartmouth College, where she teaches survey and seminar courses on biological anthropology. Her work has been published in journals such as American Anthropologist, Social Science and Medicine, American Journal of Human Biology, and the American Journal of Physical Anthropology. She received the Dartmouth College Dean of Faculty Mentoring Award in 2017, and she has also won multiple prestigious grants such as the National Institute of Health, National Institute for Minorities and Minority Health Disparities P20 grant, where she was a behavioral research fellow, and the University of Auckland School of Population Health Project Seeding Grant. Please note that a question and answer session will follow, so please hold all questions until then. Out of respect for our speaker, please stay until the end, including the question and answer session. The Clark Forum respects differences of opinions expressed thoughtfully, politely, and succinctly. Harassment of the speaker or audience member will not be tolerated. At this moment, please note, please silence all cell phones and electronic devices. In case of an emergency, the handicap accessible exits are located at the west side of the building. And now, please join me in welcoming Professor Zenaida Thayer.
All right, let's see, can you hear me? There we go. Hello, everybody. Thanks so much. Can everyone hear me? Yeah, great. All right. Thanks so much again to the organizers for inviting me down here. I've had a wonderful day and visits with lots of you, and it's really a privilege. So today I'll be talking to you about the biology of inequality. I'm an anthropologist. Any of you who have ever taken courses in anthropology might realize that we do a lot of different things. Some of us focus more on cultural variation, others on biological variation, but I think in general, something that unites all of us are trying to understand differences in human variation, whatever type it is that interests us. So within my own work, an aspect of human biological variation that I've been really interested in trying to understand is what's known as the social gradient in health. And this is the observation that both within and between societies, individuals who are socially disadvantaged tend to have shorter life expectancies and poorer health outcomes than individuals who are more socially advantaged. So there are many different ways that we can measure or demonstrate this. Here I've just pulled up some data from Pennsylvania, looking at differences in life expectancy according to ethnicity. And as it turns out, if you're a baby born in Pennsylvania, depending on your ethnicity, you can expect to live different amounts of time. So initially, when these sorts of differences were observed, it was thought that they must reflect inherent genetic differences between groups. So people might think about genes as being like the recipe and the phenotype, the biological outcome here, life expectancy, as being the bun that resulted. So genes code directly for the bun, or for the outcome. The recipe codes directly for the bun. And indeed, research within my own field of biological anthropology served to reinforce these ideas. So as you may or may not know, physical anthropology was actually originally created as a scientific study of racial classification. And in fact, the very first dissertation that was awarded to Johann Blumenbach was actually for his work describing racial differences in skull types. But many studies are now helping us to realize that these views of biological difference as reflecting inherent genetic differences between groups are probably really naive, and in fact, there's a lot more going on. So one study that's done a lot to inform our understanding of how the social gradient in health emerges is what's known as the Whitehall study. And this is a study of predominantly white, male, British civil servants who are followed over a long period of time. And what the researchers were interested in trying to understand was whether differences in occupational grade, so whether you were an administrator or a clerical worker or someone in between, whether differences in that occupational grade predicted differences in mortality risk across time. So something to pay attention to is that, again, this is a very homogeneous group of people. All individuals were stably employed across the study duration and all had equal access to healthcare. Despite these similarities, what researchers found was that there was a continuous relationship between occupational grade and mortality risk across time. And what's really surprising about this was that there was no threshold beyond which this effect ceased to exist. So you might imagine that once you have a certain amount of resources, it doesn't matter that someone else has more than you. But in fact, it does. And what this suggested to researchers was that this relationship was reflecting more than just material deprivation. And instead, there may be additional factors, for example, psychosocial stress factors, that contribute to this relationship. So within anthropology, an individual who's done a lot to inform our understanding of how the social gradient in health emerges is a man by the name of Robert Sapolsky. And in case you're wondering, he's the individual on the left. So Dr. Sapolsky does his research not among humans, but as you may have gathered from the photo, among baboons. And baboons, as it turns out, like humans, live in socially stratified societies. And what Sapolsky noted is that within these socially stratified societies, that stress is differentially allocated. And what's interesting is that differences in stress exposure were associated with differences in the activation of the stress response. And what's more, overactivation of stress hormones among individuals within that social hierarchy who experienced more stress were also more likely to develop poor health. So Sapolsky and others have wondered if similar relationships may exist for humans as well. So a point that I think is important to make, and which is probably self-evident for everyone here, is that individuals can be exposed to stress across the life course. So we now know that stress exposures in adulthood, in childhood, in infancy, and even prenatally can predict health in adulthood. Now, a lot of my research is actually focused on early life stress in the prenatal and infant period. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that just as we see disparities in birth outcomes at the end of the life course, as measured by differences in life expectancy, we also see disparities in health outcomes in the beginning of the life course. So here what we're looking at are data from Pennsylvania again, looking at the rate of low birth weight according to ethnicity. And once again, you can see that there are substantial disparities. Importantly, we now know that low birth weight is an indicator for chronic disease in later life. So being born with low birth weight actually increases your risk for developing cardiovascular disease in adulthood. And importantly, one of the predictors for low birth weight is prenatal maternal stress. So this suggests that there may be some relationship between maternal stress experience, fetal development, birth outcomes, and later life health. So today we're going to be talking about some of these things. We're going to talk a little bit more about this idea of stress physiology and intergenerational effects before talking about some of the work that I've done evaluating these effects in New Zealand. We're then going to talk about a little bit of work in prenatal stress across species before heading back to the U.S. to think about stress in childhood. All right, so when we're talking about stress, what are we talking about? Well, many stress researchers focus on this system, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Don't try and say it too many times. So basically, anytime you're stressed, such as when you're being chased down by a predator or giving some sort of public talk, your HP axis is activated, resulting in a hormonal cascade that ultimately results in the production of cortisol from the adrenal cortex. So there's a couple of different ways that we as researchers can measure cortisol. Cortisol actually varies naturally across the day. It's highest in the morning as your body is ramping up and preparing to face the challenges of the day, and then decreases in the evening as physiological systems are coming offline and your body is preparing for rest. What we find is that among individuals who are chronically stressed, that there's differences in this diurnal variation. And in particular, there tend to be elevated evening cortisol levels, which results in a reduction in that diurnal decline across the day. Another way that we can look at variation in HP axis function is by looking at cortisol response to a stressor. So as I mentioned, if we're exposed to a stressor, our cortisol levels go up about 20 to 30 minutes later. So what we can do is we can look at cortisol levels at baseline, and again, 20 to 30 minutes later, and we can look at the magnitude of the response. And so having a very elevated response or a very blunted response have both been associated with differences in chronic stress experience and potentially the development of poor health outcomes. So one of the unique things about humans is that the mere anticipation of stress is enough to activate our stress response. So it isn't only about getting chased down by predators, but it's also when you're home at night and trying to go to bed and you're thinking through all of your upcoming school deadlines, or about having financial difficulties, or even about experiencing discrimination. So all of these different types of stressors, both experienced and anticipated, can actually lead to activation of the stress response. And when overactivated, these stress hormones can then have adverse effects on health. So as an example, overactive stress hormones we know contribute to a broad range of health outcomes, including anxiety, depression, digestive problems, heart disease, sleep problems, weight gain, memory and concentration impairment, to name a few. So if you take nothing else from this talk, stress is bad for you. So easy thing to remember. Okay. Stress in very high levels is bad for you, but of course, cortisol and stress hormone exists and also has a lot of really important functions as well. And one of the times where cortisol has a really important function is actually during pregnancy. So we know that maternal cortisol levels actually increase across pregnancy. As an example, here what we're looking at are women who have never been pregnant on the far left, compared with women measured in the first, second, and third trimester. And as you can see, cortisol levels, and in particular evening cortisol levels, increase quite a lot, with levels decreasing again postpartum. The reason why we think cortisol levels increase across pregnancy or gestation is because they're actually really important for fetal development. So cortisol, some of it is able to actually cross through the placenta and is actually important for the maturation and differentiation of fetal tissues. So much so, in fact, that if infants are born very premature, they're actually administered synthetic glucocorticoids, kind of cortisol mimics, in order to promote surfactant production in the lungs so that the lungs can actually open up. That said, when maternal cortisol levels are very high, we think that it can actually have detrimental effects on fetal development. So as an example, we found that higher cortisol levels in pregnancy are actually associated with reduction in fetal growth rate, so ultimately resulting in smaller birth size, which again, as we talked about earlier, smaller birth size is associated with increased risk for developing poor health in adulthood. So given this background, an interesting question that's emerged is, can stress influence biology and health in the next generation? So the general model is as follows. Chronic stress experienced among mothers could be contributing to poor health in mothers, the basic kind of Sapolsky model, if you will. But in addition, maternal stress levels could also influence cortisol levels in pregnancy, which we know can lead to changes in fetal development, potentially affect and change cortisol levels in offspring, and therefore potentially predict poor health for those offspring in adulthood, thus contributing to an intergenerational inheritance of health disparities. So another important question is, how does stress experience influence stress physiology? What are some of the more proximate biological mechanisms through which stress can actually become encoded to affect biology? And this is where this idea of epigenetics comes in. So epi literally means above the gene. And as was nicely alluded to in the introduction, this is really more about trying to understand how environmental experiences can actually modify the way that genes are regulated vis-a-vis chemical modifications to the DNA. So what does that all mean? Let me break this down. So here's your bio primer in 30 seconds. We have our cell. Within our cell, we have all of our chromosomes. Our chromosomes are our DNA that's packaged up and wound really tightly. If we were to unwind those chromosomes, then what we get is the DNA strand. The DNA strand, the way that it's packaged up, is being wrapped around a bunch of little proteins called histones. So when we talk about epigenetic modifications, those can be occurring at the level of the DNA strand itself, so little chemical tags on the DNA strand, or it could be little chemical tags on the histones, the little proteins that the DNA wrap around. There are many different types of epigenetic modifications, but by far the most commonly studied type is DNA methylation. It's important to recognize that, again, DNA methylation is only one of many types of epigenetic regulation. When we refer to DNA methylation, what we're referring to is the attachment of a methyl group to a cytosine guanine pair. So anytime you've got that C and the G next to each other in your DNA code, there's the possibility for a methyl group to be attached. If it's attached, it's methylated. If it's not, it's unmethylated, okay? And the presence or absence, then, of that methyl group, we think, is functionally important because it can affect the way that the genes are turned on and off. So that's why we care. All right. So in contrast to the genome, which you're born with, and which, aside from mutation, is fixed across your life, the epigenome is actually sensitive to environmental exposures. So what we know is that the epigenome is sensitive to things like nutritional factors, pollution, and, important for our purposes here, psychosocial stress. So the general model is that environmental exposures can influence the epigenome, which in interaction with the genome influences actual gene expression, and therefore the phenotype, the biology that results. Okay? What's more, another important aspect of epigenetic variation is that we think that epigenetic marks can be passed across generations. Whether or not this inheritance actually occurs through direct inheritance of those epigenetic marks through gametes, or whether that inheritance occurs by kind of shared environmental experience, we aren't entirely sure. We can talk about this more in the Q&A. But we do have a number of studies suggesting that parental environmental experience can predict variation in the offspring epigenome. Okay. All right, so given all this background, one of the models that I've been really interested in trying to test is as follows. First, whether social stressors experienced in pregnancy affect maternal stress hormone levels in pregnancy. And second, whether maternal stress hormone levels in pregnancy predict differences in offspring cortisol levels after birth. And finally, I've been interested in trying to understand whether variation in the epigenome, specifically differences in DNA methylation in genes associated with cortisol functioning, may potentially facilitate these effects. So, to address this question, I went all the way around the world to New Zealand, which is down there. So I do my field work in Auckland. Auckland is a city of about 1.5 million people. One out of three Kiwis call Auckland home. So there's 4.5 million people in New Zealand. So one out of three are in Auckland. It's a very diverse city. It's actually 39% immigrant. If you look at immigrants and children of immigrants, it's actually 58% of the population. So this is a cultural context that's undergoing a lot of pretty rapid demographic shifts. Which makes it an interesting place to do this sort of research. There's also really rapidly increasing economic inequality. So Auckland is now the third most unaffordable city globally with respect to housing. So you have a lot of economic pressure being put on families, unfortunately, and really high rates of childhood poverty as well. So within New Zealand, some research has previously sought to understand how differences in economics, for example, can predict variation in health outcomes. So here what we're looking at are data where individuals were comparing those who were the most versus least materially deprived, which I'll describe more in a few minutes. And the takeaway from this is that individuals who are more materially deprived, which is a sort of index for poverty, are more likely to experience a number of chronic health conditions. Other research has also looked at area deprivation, which is an index of neighborhood quality, and similarly found that poor neighborhood quality is associated with poor health. In addition, on the New Zealand Health Survey, so the National Health Survey, they actually include questions about racial discrimination, which is pretty progressive when you think about it. So here what we're looking at are, well, these are somewhat dated data now. I'll have to update the slide. but the takeaway from this is that a lot of people within New Zealand report experiencing racial discrimination, but in particular, participants of Asian, Pacific, and Maori descent are the most likely to report experiences of discrimination. And these experiences of racial discrimination have previously been associated with outcomes such as chronic mental health conditions, worse self-rated health, and lower physical functioning. So with this background, I went to New Zealand and designed what I call the Mums Matter study because I like alliteration. And I went and recruited women from across the Auckland area. I tried to recruit a broad sample that reflected the overall demographics of the place. For recruitment, I went to prenatal health clinics and literally walked up to every single pregnant woman and said, "Hi, I'm doing a study looking at maternal health and well-being. I'd love to talk to you to hear more about your experience." If women agreed to be in the study, I went to their homes, had them do a whole questionnaire, collected their saliva to look at stress hormone levels, followed up with them again after their babies were born, collected their baby's spit, which is much harder than it sounds. You think babies drool all the time, but not actually on command. also took cheek swabs to look at DNA methylation. So in terms of measures of social environment, there were a couple of things that I was particularly interested in trying to understand. One was the impact of socioeconomic status, and the way that I measured this specifically was by looking at material deprivation. So material deprivation was a measure that was developed specifically in New Zealand, and it is a number of questions that ask about things such as, in the last 12 months, have you gone without fresh fruit or vegetables to pay for other things that you needed? In the last 12 months, have you gone without heating your home to save on costs? In the last 12 months, have you worn shoes with holes because you could not afford replacement? So those sorts of variables. I also looked at racial discrimination, and the primary way that I measured this was via the Everyday Discrimination Survey by Williams et al. So basically, this is a survey that asks about discrimination experiences that people have had in different sorts of domains, so including things like in the workplace or when trying to access healthcare. I just wanted to give you a little idea of the day of the life, a day in the life, if you will, of this sort of field work. So this is Auckland, what you're looking at here, the isthmus. So one morning, I started with an interview of a woman who lived in Mission Bay, which is a very wealthy, affluent sort of suburb, overlooks the harbor where Auckland is, very beautiful. This woman was the wife of a pastor, and the home they lived in actually was owned by the church. So they got to live there. She, so materially, was in a relatively well-off situation, but her prior pregnancy and birth experience had actually been quite traumatic. So she had a lot of stress and anxiety around this upcoming birth experience, and she told me that she'd actually been YouTubing cesarean section videos and getting very nervous about this upcoming birth process, so was experiencing a lot of stress around that. Later that day, I drove to South Auckland, where I interviewed a Samoan immigrant. This woman was living in state housing, and she had four other kids. And she talked about how in Samoa, she actually had a degree, an advanced degree, and was able to work. But when she moved to New Zealand, her advanced degree was not recognized, and she couldn't afford to get it recognized, so she was unable to work. But she wanted to stay in New Zealand because she thought that her kids would have better educational opportunities than they would back in Samoa. And finally, before going home that day, I interviewed a Tongan mother who lived in a state home also, a three-bedroom state home. There were 21 people living in the home, and she admitted that at mealtimes, the house size often swelled to 29. And so the point of this was that I interviewed a lot of different women, and they had a lot of different experiences. And when you think about stress, there are a lot of different things that we can stress about. And so something that I've become really interested in as a researcher, and which I can't fully address in this presentation today, but I think is worth thinking about, is how different types of stressors influence could have different sorts of impacts on health. So I'm happy to talk about that more again in the Q&A, but I think it's important to represent the fact that there's a big diversity of experiences here. Okay, so in all this research and all this spit gathering, what did I find? First of all, what I found was that material deprivation, both material deprivation and discrimination, were associated with higher evening cortisol levels in pregnancy. And I should mention that for this discrimination analysis, I actually adjusted for material deprivation. So what I found was that discrimination was associated with higher evening cortisol in moms, independent of the effects of material deprivation. What's more, both material deprivation and discrimination were associated with higher cortisol reactivity in the kids. And I should mention that the reason why I'm looking at cortisol reactivity in the kids and not diurnal cortisol levels is that, as anyone with babies might know, they don't establish a normal diurnal rhythm for a while. So if we want to actually look at baby cortisol, the best way to do it is by looking at reactivity. And here what I was looking at was cortisol response to vaccination at 6 weeks, which I can tell you consistently evoked a stress response. So again, material deprivation and discrimination were both associated with higher cortisol reactivity. I was then interested in trying to understand whether there were differences in methylation, DNA methylation in kids, and whether that was associated with material deprivation and discrimination or with cortisol reactivity. So what I found was that DNA methylation at this gene that's been found to be important for cortisol functioning, NR3C1, was associated with higher cortisol reactivity in the kids. When I looked at it in relation to material deprivation, there was no association. But when I looked at it in relation to discrimination, I found that there was a significant relationship. So these findings are consistent with the hypothesis that discrimination could be experienced by moms, could be impacting cortisol levels in kids via methylation changes, but also not proof of it yet. All right. More recently, I just wanted to say that in the last week, we had these data, the study just come out. So my dissertation work was a little baby study, as you may imagine, although it was a lot of work. I'm now working with a birth cohort in Auckland that was formed at the same time that has 6,800 women. So now we're trying to replicate a lot of these findings in the much larger cohort. So the paper we just had come out was looking at maternal experience of discrimination in relation to birth outcomes, which you'll remember I talked about a little bit in the introduction. And what we found was that maternal experience of discrimination was associated with significantly lower birth weight and shorter gestation length. But actually, these findings were specific to Maori indigenous women and not to women of the other ethnic groups. So we're now trying to think through how differences in the context of discrimination experience, as well as maybe differences in buffering resources, could be influencing these effects. And again, I'm happy to talk about this more in the Q&A as well. Okay, so what's going on here? One interpretation for these findings is that maternal environmental experience across her life course influences her biology in pregnancy. And a woman's biology in pregnancy actually shapes the environment in which the baby's growing and developing, and thus the baby's resultant biology. So maternal biology may be acting as an integrated signal linking maternal environmental experience with offspring biology. And so building on this kind of perspective, a question that I've been thinking about is, are these stress responses to prenatal stress in humans adaptive? And I know this sounds weird, but there's a reason for this. So Within humans, we have a lot of these studies now talking about how prenatal stress leads to adverse outcomes in offspring, including affecting stress physiology in ways that predisposes to developing poor health. However, other research in animal models actually tend to talk about similar associations, but instead of interpreting these results as pathology, they actually interpret them as being positive adaptive responses. So I think the best way to illustrate this is by way of the snowshoe hare. So Michael Sharap has these really beautiful studies where he follows snowshoe hares and their natural predator, the lynxes, in Canada across 10 years. And these two species show really classic predator-prey dynamics, where the number of hares go up, and so then the next year the number of lynxes go up, the number of hares go down, lynxes go down, right? So increase and decrease across time in response to one another. What's interesting is that in years where there's more predators, where there's more lynxes, hares that are pregnant actually have higher stress hormones and give birth to offspring that have higher stress hormones and more predator anti-avoidant behaviors. And so one way to think about this is that offspring are trying to make the most of a bad situation. So if you're living in an environment that you perceive or get signals are very stressful, where predation risk is high, you're going to increase your stress reactivity, right, to try and increase survival, knowing full well that doing so might decrease your long-term functioning and health, right? It's a trade-off. You're trying to increase survival, even if that has long-term health consequences. And so knowing that this sort of relationship had been described in hares, a project that I undertook with some students, including Dickinson alum Mary Wilson, who was my master's student, what we tried to do was actually comb the literature and find all the studies we could looking at prenatal stress in relation to offspring stress hormones across vertebrates that all share the same basic stress physiology architecture. And so we found examples from humans, non-human mammals, birds, fish, and even reptiles. So we did a thing that's called a phylogenetic meta-analysis, big words. Basically what we did was we found all these studies and combined them together and looked to see whether we could find any common patterns. What we found was that despite huge differences in terms of study design and types of species that were being studied, there was an overall trend where prenatal stress or synthetic administration of stress hormones was associated with some sort of differences in stress hormone response in offspring. And what's more, when we looked at all the different species and looked at whether they were a mammal or not, whether they had one baby or lots of babies, whether they have really big brains or really small brains, none of these factors predicted any significant variation. And so the interpretation there is that this response is really consistent across all of these different species. I think one of the interesting takeaways from this was that if we compare the sources of stress in animal studies with that in the human studies. So in the animal studies, a lot of times stress was talking about things like predation risk, so the hare example I talked about earlier. And again, in that example, we can kind of makes sense of the fact that perhaps offspring stress physiology is affected by predation risk, and that would be beneficial for the offspring. However, if we think about the sources of stress in the human studies we reviewed, discrimination, poverty, pollution, trauma, 9/11, the Holocaust, these are all anthropogenic sources of stress, right? And all these anthropological sources of stress are resulting in these adverse effects on health. So just an interesting thing to take away. All right, so I've talked a bit then about this work, about how prenatal and early life stressors can influence health in adulthood. More recently, I've moved on to thinking about how even later in development, we also can be sensitive to stress. And so some of my more recent work has focused on trying to understand whether stress exposures in childhood can predict biological function and health in adulthood. And in doing this work, I've actually left New Zealand and returned to the US, and I've actually been working in native health. So as a point of reference, there's 2.9 million individuals who self-identify as American Indian or Alaska Native in the US. And just for reference, this is a population which experiences a lot of really important disparities in health. So looking at the beginning of the life course, for example, we know that mortality rates are significantly higher in Native Americans compared to whites. If we look at the other end of the life course in terms of life expectancy, we can see that American Indian Alaska Native male actually has the shortest life expectancy out of any ethnicity within the U.S. So it's really important that we do more research to try and understand the sources of this disparity, because I think this is a population that's really been understudied within health disparities research. So with this background, I've been doing work with a couple of reservation communities in the Northern Plains. And in particular, data for this study come from my colleague, Dr. Spiro Manson, who's the head for the Center of American Indian and Alaska Native Health at the University of Colorado. And so data that I'll be talking about come from this AI SuperFIP study primarily, which was a study assessing mental health outcomes and healthcare utilization amongst individuals from tribal communities in the Northern Plains. And so data for this come from 1,600 participants. Of those participants, 197 were invited for a follow-up study, the Healing Heart Study. We were able to collect a lot of additional biomarkers of health from those individuals. So the main exposure that I'll actually be talking about in reference to this study is our Indian boarding schools, which in Carlisle is something normally I have to give this introduction and talk about. Have you ever heard of? But as I'm sure many of you are aware, between 1879 and the mid-1900s, the federal government transported over 830,000 kids from off of the reservation and to boarding schools. So here's the Carlisle school here. So what seems like a really basic question, but which unfortunately hadn't even been asked until we and some other researchers from Canada published on this last year, was whether boarding school attendance is actually associated with poor health in adulthood. So within our sample, and this, again, this is a sample from the Northern Plains, 46% of individuals attended boarding school. What we found is that, perhaps unsurprisingly, boarding school attendance was associated with the development of a number of chronic health conditions in adulthood. What's more, we also tried to look at specific stressors associated with boarding school experience. So, for example, were you punished for using your native language? Were you not allowed to go home on breaks? Things like this. And what we found was that those two exposures specifically were, so within the boarding school cohort, among individuals who attended boarding school, those who experienced these specific exposures also had poor health in adulthood. So if you went to a boarding school, not great. And then, of course, there's differences in terms of that experience. And those who experienced more stressors or traumas also had poor health. A final analysis that I did with this cohort actually was looking at the impacts of early life trauma in general, so not specific to boarding school attendance. And what I sought to try to understand was whether early life trauma would be associated with differences in allostatic load in adulthood. And for reference, allostatic load here is a compilation of 13 different biomarkers that assess health from a broad range of physiological systems, things like immune health and neuroendocrine biomarkers and metabolic functioning. So I was interested in seeing whether there was a direct relationship between early life trauma and allostatic load, or whether these effects would be mediated by PTSD development, knowing that early life trauma is also increases your risk of developing post-traumatic stress disorder. And so long story short, what we found was that early life trauma was significantly associated with higher allostatic load, but only among people who also developed PTSD. And when we looked at the different physiological systems included within our measure of allostatic load, we found that the neuroendocrine system was the most strongly affected. And so I think these results are interesting for a number of ways. One of the things I'm really interested in trying to do is to follow up this cohort again and see whether differences in neuroendocrine functioning at this point predict differences in cardiovascular or metabolic outcomes at a later time point. Because again, we think that stress biomarkers can be influencing chronic disease risk in other systems. Okay, so again, individuals can be exposed to health stress across the life course, and hopefully I provided some evidence that early life stressors can have these important effects. But a point I want to make related to that last study is that I was really interested in this observation that it was only among individuals who experienced early life trauma and who developed PTSD that had differences in allostatic load. So it makes this question of why do some people who experience early life trauma develop PTSD while others don't an interesting one, right? In other words, what contributes to resilience in the face of stressor or trauma exposure? Because that could be an important point of intervention. And so building on that, something that I'm hoping to incorporate more in my future research is this indigenous model of trauma coping and health outcomes. And the idea here is that different types of trauma can, of course, affect health outcomes, as I've been talking to you about. But in addition, there could be different sorts of cultural buffers, things like identity attitudes, spiritual coping, traditional health practices that may buffer these stressor exposures on health. And so we need more research actually trying to assess these things and their efficacy. And I think what's really important about emphasizing cultural buffers here is that they're things that are coming from the community, right? That the community is already doing that we can hopefully promote in terms of increasing resources, for example. And the last point I want to make is that in doing this research, I think I would be remiss to not talk about this idea of historical trauma. And this is another direction that in my work I'm really moving towards. So historical trauma, as some of you may already know, is defined as the complex and collective trauma experienced over time and across generations by a group of people who share an identity, affiliation, or circumstance. So this is a concept that was actually originally created to describe in response to the Holocaust. So researchers found that children of individuals who survived the Holocaust were more likely to develop adverse mental health outcomes relative to individuals who were Jewish but whose parents didn't experience the Holocaust. So this made the researchers wonder if maybe there's something about your parents experiencing this sort of extreme collective traumatic event that could affect the health of descendant generations. In 1995, Maria Yellowhorse was the first person to talk about this in the context of colonization and Native Americans. So I think a really important component of historical trauma that I've learned about as I've done more research about it is the idea that the nature of historical trauma is such that it's not only that your ancestors experienced trauma, but the nature of those traumatic historical events actually have implications for the current generation. In other words, stressors that the current generation experience can be traced in some instances in part to that historic event. So what do I mean by that? We're thinking about these things in terms of secondary traumas. And so one example of this might be public reminders of historical traumas. So I'll remind you all of the Confederate statue controversy, right, that's been going on the last few years. So why is it that removing these statues is such an important thing to many people? Well, imagine that you're part of a group whose very existence was marginalized by the person who's being put into a public space in a position of reverence, right? So this is a public reminder of a historic trauma. So this is one example of a way in which an individual might be exposed to a contemporary reminder of that historical trauma. Another example of this might be discrimination. So again, many different groups experience discrimination, and it's not to take away from any of that. However, if you're part of a group that has been historically marginalized, then maybe experiencing that discrimination has added salience. And finally, an example that has been applied to Native Americans specifically, but which I think has implications for other groups also, is this idea of historical loss. And this was a concept developed by Les Whitbeck, where he actually asked, it was developed with Native elders, and what he found was that individuals, elders, and even youth spend a lot of time thinking about things like loss of land, loss of language, loss of culture, loss of traditional spiritual ways. And so people are thinking about these things in their day-to-day lives. And this can also be a source of stress. So So given all of this background, a student and I developed what we were calling the historical trauma and health model, just trying to think about ways in which we could actually create a testable model to see the extent to which historical trauma could be affecting health. So again, the question is, can an original trauma experienced by an ancestral generation, can that be associated with health many generations later? And so we argue that there's at least two non-mutually exclusive pathways through which this can occur. The first is that the original trauma can lead to secondary traumas, which I described a few minutes ago, such that all of these subsequent generations are actually being directly exposed to stressors and traumas themselves. And so secondary trauma exposure could lead to changes in stress physiology in the epigenome, like we've been talking about throughout this talk. And that then could influence mental and physical health outcomes. In addition, recognizing that there's biological and behavioral continuity between generations, we argue that historical trauma could affect stress levels in mothers, for example, during pregnancy, that this can affect stress hormone exposures for offspring. These stress hormones can also be present in breast milk, for example, infect offspring. An individual who's experienced trauma that may affect their parenting behavior, right, and how they're able to parent their children, all these things could lead to changes in stress physiology in the epigenome and therefore shape risk for developing mental and physical health in adulthood. So that's our model. We're trying to get it out there, and I hope people can pick up and try and test these ideas. So to end, I want to go back to this very simple schemata that I open with, this idea that genes are the recipe and the phenotype is the bun that results. I hope that I've convinced you all that while, yes, the recipe is important, the environment or the oven in which the bun is baked is also important for influencing health outcomes. And while this is really cutesy, I do think it's important to make the point that when we're talking about things like health disparities, actually talking about the contributions of the environment are really important. Because if it's only genes that are affecting health outcomes, that means there's nothing we can do about it. But if it's the environment that's affecting health outcomes, all of a sudden there's an aspect of this formula that we can actually modify, right? And so trying to understand the ways in which the environment affects those outcomes, I think, is really important. So thank you very much for your time.
We will now begin the question and answer session. Since the event is being recorded, please wait for the mic to reach you to ask your question. As an undergraduate institution, we'll reserve the first questions for students. We'll now take the first questions.
Hi there. Thank you so much for your talk. It was really, really interesting. A question that occurred to me that's like kind of little and specific is about when you're talking about cortisol levels in pregnancy and how maternal cortisol levels are higher when they're pregnant versus when people are not pregnant. And I was wondering if it's been studied or if people know if it's different, whether or not it's your first pregnancy or if it's like a second or third pregnancy, if like your levels are higher or lower based on that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And until recently, there hadn't been any studies about that. So my colleague Molly Fox actually just published a study on that last year, and I can't currently recall what she found. But Molly Fox, cortisol levels across pregnancies, and she addresses exactly that question. I'm sorry that I can't recall the result immediately, but it's a great question that we didn't know until recently. Yeah.
Are you aware of any studies that have occurred where you study a certain population that's known to have habitual poverty or something to see if there's been any genetic modification in the way that cortisol gets expressed during pregnancy?
Yeah, I don't know of anything like that.
Hello, my name is Carmen. My question was, now that we like excuse me, now that we have this understanding of how social environments or environments affect the epigenome and how that can be passed down generationally, can you speak more on how that can affect like social classes and how that is interconnected with discrimination, like a little bit more?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think that one of the fears sometimes in doing this research is that when we document things like poverty are associated with differences in the epigenome or health, it can actually serve to reify ideas of biological difference, right? And then sometimes we describe these as developmental programming effects, and programming makes it sound like it's fixed and permanent. So I really think that, I mean, all of this research is in really early stages, so it's all very descriptive at this point. But I think we do need a lot more studies looking at the impacts of intervention and trying to understand more about the reversibility of these effects, because that might allow us to develop interventions to actually improve outcomes. Right now we're at the stage of documenting associations, but hopefully in the coming years we could move to the next stage of actually trying to reverse these effects.
I'm interested in whether or not you're able to take all the important variables into account. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that interested me in my own family is that I was 12 years younger than my brother, mm-hmm. and 7 years younger than my sister. Mm-hmm. And my mother was an older mother at mm-hmm. that point. And this was before people really understood. This was in about 1947 or so on. People didn't really understand the effect of late pregnancies, but there was a kind of a fad that women who had a late pregnancy should take a lot of medication. And my mother had bottles and bottles, and she every morning she'd go through and take three of these and two of those and so on. And so there were two factors when my sister was born. My mother was older, and she took all these medications, and my sister did indeed have many more medical problems mm-hmm. when she was growing up. And I wonder to what extent that's been taken into account in some of your studies.
Yes, that's a great question. So in all these studies, and I didn't have a chance to go into that, but in all these studies, we adjust for factors that we know are going to be important, things like maternal age, in some instances, maternal size, right? Because maternal size is going to influence birth weight. Education, actually. So we'll adjust for socioeconomic variables when we're looking at impacts of discrimination. You raise a good point. There are many different factors that could be influencing these outcomes. So the advantage of working with a very big study now is that we can adjust for more of these covariates. Yeah, thank you.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I was wondering if other stressors such as pollutions or malnutrition, if you've studied those or have other studies that talk about what those stressor would lead to and how it would affect offsprings?
Yeah, so a lot of my primary research is focused on psychosocial stressors, but I've also read about and tried to think through how some of these other things can affect health. So research by a lot of other people has demonstrated the impacts of toxicants, for example, on the epigenome, and of course on health. So there is a really robust literature around that. In terms of nutritional stress, actually available of different micronutrients are also important for methylation. So that can have some really direct effects. And there's these really cool studies in mice, for example, where they can reverse different methylation vis-a-vis nutritional supplementation. So that's also an interesting thing to consider. And then we've also thought about nutritional stress a little bit more, actually, from the perspective of evolution and thinking about the idea that perhaps humans are more buffered to nutritional stress during pregnancy relative to rats or other smaller species. And we've thought through then how that could be an explanation for why despite the fact that we know that maternal nutrition in general is important for influencing birth outcomes, if you do a really short-term intervention in pregnancy and just give a woman a bunch of calories, it actually doesn't translate into big improvements in birth outcomes.
Thank you. What kind of policy implications either have you seen or do you foresee or do you think may be coming forth from your research? I can think of so many areas, whether it's allocation of health resources, something as simple as not blaming victims, having better health supplies, quicker interventions, allocations of funds. There's so many policy implications. I'm really interested to hear your thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, this has applications for a lot of different things, as you're alluding to. I think one of my primary goals, if I had to pick one, would be increasing prenatal care and just maternal child health more generally, and trying to make sure that interventions aren't only focused on the specific pregnancy, but also on across children's development, right? Because we know that all of prenatal and all of childhood are really sensitive periods for development. And so if you're only, you know, having little interventions at small time points and not actually increasing environments overall, then you might not be getting big effects. So some of my other work that I didn't really talk about here, I think also advocates for, you know, greater leave as well for parents. When we think about the importance of breastfeeding, for example, and the important effects of breast milk on development.
Hi, thanks very much for your talk. It was really enlightening. Is measuring cortisol in infants common practice? And are there potential benefits from increasing the frequency with which we know the cortisol levels in infants and thinking about what kinds of interventions might be done if they're too high? And if I could just follow up with kind of related to that question, I would just want to make sure I understood you in the early part of your talk. You were talking about the, I think it was the stress response neonatally, and that if the a blunted response could have negative health implications. Is that, did I understand you?
And
why would that be?
So in blunted stress response, you oftentimes see in cases of PTSD, actually. So PTSD is interesting in that relative to other anxiety disorders, it's actually associated with reduced cortisol levels and reduced cortisol reactivity. So it's actually quite interesting. Something I didn't talk about here was that in my study, I also looked at maternal PTSD symptoms. And moms who had higher PTSD symptoms, their kids actually had a blunted cortisol response. And so in looking at the literature, we don't really know factors that may precede PTSD development, right? That question, how come some people experience trauma and others don't? There is an idea that early trauma experience could prime subsequent PTSD development in response to traumas in adulthood, but I do think it's an interesting hypothesis that HPA axis function could actually be primed for this as well. But that's very speculative. In response to your other question, there are a number of developmental psychologists, actually, who have done a lot of measurement of cortisol levels in infancy. And what's also, so as I mentioned, you don't get that normal diurnal rhythm, high in the morning, low in the evening, until kids are about 6 months at least. And so a lot of earlier measurements will focus on response to vaccination, or there's these other procedures that they've developed. Still face procedure, for example, where you look at a baby with a really still face and that stresses them out. Or you don't do it. Or you separate the parent, you know, and make the baby cry. I didn't want to do those things, so I looked at their vaccination response. But what's interesting is that at about a year, it's much more difficult to elicit a cortisol response until I think like 3 or 4 years. So there's like this period of hyporeactivity as well. But I guess to your point, I think we need a lot more research to talk about what's healthy or not healthy in terms of infant cortisol. We need longitudinal studies to see how stable these responses are.
For how many generations afterwards are there elevated levels of cortisol?
Yes, that's a good question. I mean, this work I'm talking about is only, you know, intergeneration, one generation to the next. And I think, and obviously when we're studying humans, we don't really have the data, unfortunately, to be looking across many more generations than that. But I think that it's important to think about the mechanisms through which these things are inherited. To the extent to which, if a mom has higher cortisol levels, for example, she's experienced a lot of stress, if that leads to elevated stress hormones in utero, then that could affect the offspring stress physiology. And assuming that things don't necessarily change for the offspring, then that could be, you know, inherited. But there's a confounding variable of, like, common environmental experience. Right? So in order to really test that question empirically, we need to have generations having qualitatively different experiences so we can see whether these things are really stably inherited or whether just reflect, you know, commonalities in terms of stress experience across generations, because I think that's really important in the real world.
Hi. Thank you for your talk. It was great. I really enjoyed it. So I'm also an anthropologist.
Oh, yay.
Yay. Yeah. And so I was really encouraged by your discussion of using an indigenous model of trauma. And of course, right, anthropology is partly responsible for its own sort of share, right, of historical trauma, mm-hmm. especially. Mm-hmm. On indigenous peoples in the Americas. And so I was wondering, one, because of that history, right, how your working relationship with indigenous peoples, activists, health practitioners, and scientists is mm-hmm. sort of going along, right, how it's developing, mm-hmm. If you could speak to that a little bit. And then if you could also maybe speak to whether or not you see your current work as sort of helping to repair or mend the relationship between indigenous peoples and anthropologists and scientists?
Yeah, it's a great question. So as I mentioned, this study was designed and really executed by Spiro Manson, who is a mentor of mine and who's amazing and has been doing lots of amazing work with Native communities for a long time. So I really piggybacked on the pre-existing study and relationships he had. But I think what I've learned from that model, of course, is that it's really important to be working with communities in terms of how you design your study, make sure that oftentimes we'll have tribal review of the papers before they're submitted. And then we've also made an effort, obviously, to make our research accessible by doing things such as we presented some of this work at an ACF tribal grantees meeting, which was really cool because it was tribal grantees who are working in communities around children's health and social intervention. And so we talked about some of our research because then they could incorporate that into their grant applications to then support more Healthy Start programming and things like that. So trying to create those collaborative initiatives. And what's more, I don't know if you're familiar with Ripon Malhi and the Summer Institute of Native Genomics. I just want to highlight it because I think it's a great example of anthropologists who are really trying to work, and in that instance, work to increase capacity of Native genomics people who study genomics. And so Sing was founded by Ripon, and now it brings in Native undergrads and grad students every year to train them in genomics principles and also how to interpret genetics research as a capacity-building project. And now there's a Sing Canada and a Sing Aotearoa New Zealand. So I do think that anthropologists are trying to right the wrongs. We need to. Thanks for your question.
We have time for one more question.
Going in a completely different direction, have you figured out like a length of time that somebody has to be exposed to like a level of psychosocial stress in order for it to affect this like epigenetic like process?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I guess the way that I conceptualize it is I'm really thinking about people's like lived experience. And if you think about it, a lot of these stressors I'm measuring aren't about a single acute kind of event, right? It's about your everyday kind of chronic overall experience and interpretation of the world. And so because of that, I would anticipate that those sorts of experiences are what's really important for impacting your biology. That's not to say that there can't be one-off traumatic events that couldn't affect you as well, but I've intentionally kind of tried to focus on these sorts of exposures for that reason. Thanks.
That concludes tonight's event. Please join me in thanking Professor Thayer.